From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. When a small biotech company called Advanced Cell Technology announced this week that it had cloned a human embryo, headlines blazed across the country and much of the world. President Bush condemned the experiment. One senator called for a ban on research. Religious groups staged protests, and the opinion pages ominously opined. Act wisely, not quickly, said the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Don't stifle research, replied the LA Times. Cloning a moral dead end, said the Dallas Morning News. Meanwhile, reporters struggled through a thicket of scientific, ethical, and political issues, among them NPR science correspondent Joe Palca. Joe, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
First of all, is this really the big news that it was touted as?
From a scientific standpoint, it's extremely modest. You could even call it a failure. But from a political, social standpoint, the interest in this issue has been phenomenal because the public, and certainly Congress, is extremely interested in the question of whether anybody should be allowed to create embryos using cloning technology.
Howie Kurtz of the Washington Post put together a couple of news reports, one from U.S. News and World Report, that suggested that they had successfully engineered the world's first cloned human embryo, and then the one from the New York Times that said cloning experts outside the company said the experiment was a failure. So we can't tell, or a cursory reading of the paper wouldn't necessarily yield that important nugget of information.
The problem here is a semantic one, in a sense, because if you say that this six-celled thing is an embryo, then the truth is that they did create a cloned embryo. It's the first one. The fact that it wasn't viable, the fact that it didn't reach the point where they were hoping to derive stem cells from it, the fact that they don't even know whether the genetic material inside that embryo was actually directing its reproduction or whether this was some vestigial reproduction left over from an activated egg. There's a lot of scientific questions that haven't been answered. I think we can be fairly certain that it's a better story, both from the company's standpoint and from the news media's standpoint, to say, we've cloned the first embryo, because it's 100% true. The fact that you then have to say, but it died almost immediately, or it didn't grow, and it was, you know, not even sure it was a successful experiment, well, you could put that into the third paragraph or the fourth paragraph.
How would you assess the way news outlets have been handling the story, then, in general?
I think, in general, it's so easy to confuse terminology here because we never used to talk about what's an embryo. An embryo was something you got when you had an egg with a sperm and it started to grow. That was an embryo. Now we've got something that, you know, is it an embryo because it's got no sperm and even part of the egg has been changed? I mean, what is this thing? So there's a terminology issue. And there's also the question of what people mean by cloning. Everybody now thinks of cloning as creating an entire new animal. Dolly was a cloned sheep. But there are things you can do with cloning technology that are never intended to grow into a live human being. It's just complicated. The terminology is not in the public's mind so clearly that you can just throw it around. And so you wind up spending a lot of time in any news story, if you do it responsibly, talking about technical details, which, you know, a lot of people, when you get into technical details in science, they start to glaze over a little bit.
This kind of story is so fraught with social implications that it's in the interest of science and in the interest of advocates to adjust the terminology, adjust the way that these issues are addressed. What are some of those phrases that you say aren't yet in the public mind that science would like to put there?
In terms of what the scientists are talking about, they're simply saying, well, let's call this technique what it is. It's somatic cell nuclear transfer. But, you know, that's not a term that trips off the tongue. And so I think scientists realize they got to try something different. You know, I don't think it's going to be just a question of picking the right names for these things to make everybody say, oh, yes, I see what you mean, and we all agree now.
On Sunday and Monday, when you saw this story reported, either on television or in the newspapers or on the radio, was there any story or any particular take that had you wringing your hands going, no, no, no?
The only mistake or inaccuracy is to overstate the importance of an incremental change for the purpose of making a good story. The incremental scientific advance here was extremely modest. But the story, nonetheless, was a good one, and from a societal standpoint, I think an important one. And so if I ever say, oh, no, no, I can't believe that, it's because these stories take on a life that has little to do with their intrinsic scientific importance.
Joe, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Joe Palca is a science correspondent for National Public Radio.
The topic dominating news in Iran this fall has been the World Cup soccer finals. This is no casual matter because celebrations after the games have turned into political rallies against the ruling conservative clerics. To tamp down that unrest, police have confiscated all of the satellite dishes they can find. Increasingly, Iranians have relied on these dishes for news and entertainment from around the world. And in Los Angeles, a city with hundreds of thousands of Iranian Americans, expatriates with money to burn are broadcasting a heady mix of music and politics to the home country via satellite TV. From KPCC in Los Angeles, Rachel Miro reports.
It's 8 in the morning in North Hollywood, home of National Iranian TV. While most Angelenos are stuck in traffic on their way to work, Zia Atabey is broadcasting live to Tehran, where at 7:30 p.m., prime time.
Salam be sarzamin Kurosh, salam be sarzamin madari man, salam be onjayi ke ishq dar qalb man be khater un faryad mizane.
With eyebrows dancing up and down, the 59-year-old host of You and Television holds court each Wednesday and Friday for 2 hours at a stretch. His long monologues are punctuated by music videos, interviews, and phone calls from viewers around the world. Sometimes the program goes on for longer, sometimes it stops short, which doesn't seem to matter since Atabey owns the network.
I owed that country because I had the best time in Iran when I was singer, best life, best money, and everything. And now that I thought I have money in here, I could live peacefully, very good. And I was.
Before the 1979 revolution that deposed the late Shah of Iran, Atabey was a successful singer and executive with CBS Records' Tehran affiliate. Over here, he and his wife amassed a new fortune with two surgical clinics. They bought homes. They went shopping in Europe. But something was missing.
When I'm dying, what happened? My children will say, my father was singer, famous singer, and died. Or they can say, my father made something that didn't exist in our history. My father made independent global networking television for freedom of Iran.
For Atabey, this is clearly a labor of love. The operation functions out of just one studio space and two control rooms the size of broom closets. Programming is a folksy blend of music, news, sports, old films, and cooking shows. While he manages to run the network on just $220,000 a month, Atabey's losing $140,000 a month. A year and a half into the venture, it's not clear how much longer this self-styled Ted Turner can keep his dream alive. Atabey doesn't even know how many viewers he has. That will change now that he's begun to charge subscription fees to viewers in North America and Europe. Satellite dishes are illegal in Iran, but Atabey is counting on another revolution to change that.
Imagine if tomorrow Iran will be a free country. We have a 72 million. If 10 million of them, that I'm sure is more than that. But if 10 million of them, they pay me not $10 per month, not 20, $1 will be $10 million per month. So this is a big company with a good future.
In Tarangelis, as some people jokingly call it, the community has long supported several local radio and TV stations. NITV was the first to broadcast to a worldwide audience 24/7. And now, believe it or not, there's competition. On a recent Friday night in West Hollywood, about 250 people paid $250 a plate to see local musicians perform and hear from community celebrities like Mikabis Mohajer, the host of Spotlight, a youth-oriented talk show on Topish TV.
I want to thank the people that have given us a chance to go global. It is our responsibility as Iranians to teach our kids about our 7,500-year history, to teach them to be proud of being Iranian, but at the same time, to respect all others. My heart does beat every second of the day for this network. Thank you so much. God bless you.
Topish TV, like NITV, is convinced that its programs fill an urgent need back in Iran. But Mehram Kamrava, a political professor at the California State University at Northridge, says that's less true now than it was 30 years ago.
The cultural atmosphere in Iran is not as closed as it used to be.
Kamrava visited Iran 11 months ago, after 22 years away. This man, whose job it is to know what's going on in the Middle East, says he was shocked to find Iranians engaged in sophisticated political debates and clamoring for tickets to local musical concerts.
Many of the Iranian expatriates who live outside of Iran are unaware, or at best are superficially aware, of the very significant cultural dynamics brewing underneath the surface in Iran. And so it isn't as if you have a culture or a society that is starved of any sort of musical or artistic outlet.
Black market satellite dishes in Iran have been pulling in foreign broadcasts for years. CNN, BBC, Arabsat, Al Jazeera, The Voice of America, even the Iranian government's own network, Pars TV. According to Kamrava, the market is already saturated with sophisticated news and entertainment. But Ali Raza Mirkhosami, Tapish TV's creative director, argues there is a niche for Farsi programming that isn't government-sponsored. He knows the competition is tough, but he's also willing to bet that his ace in the hole is a talent pool schooled in the ways of American TV.
And the people who live in the United States, there is a thing in their home called remote control. So if you don't do a right job, they click you, and instead of watching you guys, they watch Jay Leno or they watch, you know, David Letterman.
In other words, if you can make it in L.A., you can make it anywhere, be it Berlin or Kandahar. The thing is, Mirkhosami doesn't have much time to test his theory. He says the network has enough funds and enthusiasm to last only about 6 to 8 months. Tapish TV isn't going to work unless it attracts big advertising money. And back at NITV, Zia Atabey admits it hasn't been so easy to do that.
I don't understand it. Why Pepsi Cola doesn't give me the advertising to survive, man. Why? I don't know.
If you could deposit optimism in a bank, NITV and Tapish TV would have no problem. Their challenge now is to prove there really is a hunger for independent Farsi TV, beaming direct to the world from sunny Southern California. For On the Media, I'm Rachel Miro in Los Angeles.
Coming up, public information dries up, actors get by on bad looks, and a movie critic's tough love.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. The federal government's instructions to libraries were explicit and unprecedented. Locate a CD-ROM of federal data on dams and reservoirs and destroy it. Terrorism fears have triggered a series of government actions, all aimed at keeping potentially actionable intelligence out of terrorists' hands. Joining us now is Brant Houston, Executive Director of the Investigative Reporters and Editors Organization. Brant, welcome to OTM.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Since the attacks in September, government agencies have been removing information from their websites and asking libraries and other databases to destroy certain documents. What are some of the consequences of this?
The first major consequence of this is to deny the public and the press information about public safety and threats to public safety. Dateline NBC did a sort of template story on using the dam information several years ago. And it was just, I mean, there are hundreds of dams out there that aren't getting repaired that they say they can have sunny day failures. We're just kind of waiting for these little disasters to happen. Some of them can be big.
So another way of looking at this is, by closing off these databases, the government is effectively shutting down the early warning system to any number of scandals or public safety disasters that could be looming on the horizon.
That is exactly accurate. They're closing down the early warning system. We don't have any problems with people erring on the side of caution, but there's really no notification or discussion of what's being removed. For example, FAA enforcement data has been removed. Well, only 25% of that data concerns airport security. There's lots of information in there about violations of transportation of hazardous materials. After all, that's something that brought down the value jet outside Miami. There's information about violations of flight operations, lack of reporting, correct reporting on problems, and maintenance problems, which, of course, are of interest to everybody that's looking into the Queen's crash. So it's not really being thought out very well.
I think the public is mostly sympathetic with the government in its increasing restrictions. I think what they see is a knee-jerk reaction from the press, which wants to sort of compulsively have access to material that the public doesn't quite get why the press has to have.
If you're going to have a free and open and democratic society, you're going to have a press that can keep government officials accountable.
The Freedom of Information Act has gotten, let's say, a fresh interpretation by Attorney General Ashcroft since September 11th. And he seems to be telling agencies, federal agencies, contrary to federal policy going back a couple of decades, that they should withhold information if they can. Is this just an opportunity knocking for a government that is interested in suppression?
The idea of the Freedom of Information Act was that everything should be disclosed except what you really, really need to keep private. I think the government is trying to turn this interpretation upside down. There is always a tension between the press and the government. The government always wants to withhold more information than it should. With, I have to say, industry lobbyists pushing them on, I think it gets a much more custodial feeling over some of the data.
One of the things that's happened is that libraries have been directed to destroy documents that they'd had in the public records. That's kind of chilling.
I think it's very chilling. I've been saying to people, there's no longer a chilling effect out there. There's an Arctic zone. Thankfully, other federal agencies are stepping up and saying, I'm not quite sure you have the right to destroy this, telling the libraries to hold up.
But now that Pandora's box has been closed, will it ever open again?
I think we go through cycles. I think it was closed before the Freedom of Information Act and Sunshine Laws came along. I do think there will be, if not a backlash, a recognition and awareness of what's going on. It'll start when the public is told that we're taking care of things, don't worry about it, and things aren't taken care of.
Brant Houston, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Brant Houston is Executive Director of Investigative Reporters and Editors and an Associate Professor at the University of Missouri School of Journalism.
The Farrelly Brothers comedy Shallow Hal has been a box office success, but it's also been boycotted by the National Association to Advance Fat Acceptance. One overweight person who hasn't protested is Ivy Snitzer, Gwyneth Paltrow's 300-pound body double in the film. She says the film has a sweet message and takes the jokes in stride. But where does a casting director turn to find actors who aren't the Apollonian ideal of physical beauty and don't mind being the butt of the joke? A few months ago, Garfield went to the West Coast to find out.
They flock here to Los Angeles to convert their looks into Hollywood careers because, let's face it, not everybody is a natural talent like Keanu Reeves or Heather Graham. Most of the wannabes are just striking faces on an 8x10.
We get like a big stack of like 25 or so submissions in the mail every day. Literally, I have every person's hopes and dreams sitting on my desk, and they all think that they're going to be movie stars.
Robin Harrington is the co-owner of Dragon, the talent agency, a bulky elevator ride above Wilshire Boulevard. Dragon is not the ordinary Hollywood magnet for the impossibly gorgeous, however. The headshots here are conspicuously thin on square jaws, high cheekbones, and perfect pearly smiles. In fact, a good part of the clientele is pretty heinous looking, which works out very well for them because at the moment, as measured by the casting breakdowns with physical specifications for roles in TV, film, and advertising, we are in a raging bull market for the unsightly.
Braces, freckles, pimples, too skinny, heavy. It's rare that I see the breakdown that is looking for the gorgeous beauty. It's all about real people right now. Like, we are looking for inbred.
There will always be a demand for gods and goddesses, of course, but the trend now is toward geek chic. And worse.
The majority of the people that I cast these days are beyond real.
Casting agent Kathy Carlton sits in her West L.A. office sifting through 8x10s.
Like this guy right here, Chip.
Yeah, he's not hideous, but, you know, Omar Sharif, he ain't.
No. This girl, I think she's about 6'2". Sweet as can be, you know. She works a lot. But she's definitely not beautiful. Then we have Bunny Summers, who is just a sweetheart, and it's all about her weight and her jowls, and she just makes the best of it, loves it. You know, booked her many times. You know, she just enjoys her layers there.
It may seem counterintuitive in a town where superficiality runs so deep that a young woman would regard her weight and jowls as a meal ticket, but there you are. Take Vincent Schiavelli. He is not, strictly speaking, a handsome guy. His ultra-drooping eyes give him a basset hound look that is so severe he's only been able to get parts in 80 movies. 80 movies. Just to put that in perspective, Brad Pitt has been in 23 movies. Of course, none of Brad Pitt's was Rescue from Gilligan's Island.
My face is my fortune, baby. But on the other hand, somehow the particular nature of my looks, people might tend to think that I am a certain way that I'm not.
He's not deeply depressed, for example, or deranged, or a ghost, even though he played one in Ghost. He's a trained actor who likes to take advantage of what he calls his physicality, without the parts being about his physicality. When directors call looking for that strange-looking guy with the eyes, he'd prefer to say no, but...
You have to do them because you have to work, because you have bills to pay and you have expenses and so on and so forth. Then it's like, okay, let's go to work. Yeah.
I think we like to laugh, and we don't laugh at beautiful people.
Rich Silverstein of Goodby Silverstein & Partners, the San Francisco ad agency, has often cast TV spots with the unbeautiful. A recent commercial for E-Trade was about a grotesque Gloria Swanson type getting an erotic pedicure from her pool boy. Another, for Frito-Lay, used a family of overweight trailer trash to demonstrate Frito's new crush-proof packaging. They say there are no small parts, only small actors. These are extremely large actors cast for their girth, but Silverstein says he had no difficulty getting people to audition.
Andy Warhol was so right. Everyone can be famous for 15 minutes, and no one says no.
Yeah, but you've got to wonder, when the agent calls saying, Frito-Lay is looking for obese, obnoxious losers, are you available? What goes on in the actor's mind? In terms of self-image, in terms of self-esteem, in terms of just plain human vanity, doesn't that take a toll?
And I played with some very interesting people, such as Hervé Villechaize from Fantasy Island.
Meet Coco Barrett of the comedy team Coco and Penny. Once upon a time, she was a buxom young character actress and comedienne who got tantalizingly close to success in New York. Now she is in Hollywood, much older, much heavier, garishly clad and coiffed, all teased hair and leopard skin, still trying to break through.
I've done Law and Order, and I played a landlady. Very often I play a gypsy. In Carlito's Way, I played a fortune teller. They're not casting me as a glamorous young girl.
When Goodby Silverstein was looking for a grossly sexual Gloria Swanson, Coco jumped at the opportunity.
I just loved that one. I wish I could do that one. It was wonderful.
You wish you had the part where the idea was to look repulsive.
I guess so. I don't mind being me. I don't mind at all.
I'm reminded of the words of James Baldwin, which I read just now in Bartlett's quotations. The price we pay when pursuing any art or calling is an intimate knowledge of its ugly side. But maybe the reverse is true as well. The benefit we get from ugliness is a more intimate relationship with art.
On Friday in New York City, there was a remarkable cultural event, a memorial for a film critic mounted at the fervent request of filmmakers. Pauline Kael, the diminutive indomitable film critic for The New Yorker, died in early September, and much was made of her influence on a whole generation of critics. But her impact on film audiences and filmmaking may have been greater still. Robert Towne has written or doctored dozens of scripts, including Shampoo, Bonnie and Clyde, Chinatown, and The Godfather, and he's on the line from his home in Los Angeles. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Brooke.
And here in the studio with us is David Edelstein, film reviewer for Slate.com, and one of the youngest of a circle that has come to be called the Paulettes. Now, David, you don't like that term, do you?
No, I don't. I prefer to think of myself not as someone who sat on the lap of the queen bee, but someone who learned a good deal and appreciates that aesthetic and continues to fight the good fight. I am a Paulinista.
Now, Ms. Kael was known to champion her favorites, whether critic or director or screenwriter. Mr. Towne, it's safe to say you were one of those.
Yes, but I don't think she had ever had any hesitation, especially with favorites of hers, if there was something she didn't like.
Can you tell me about an experience when Pauline Kael did take on the role as champion?
Well, certainly in the case of Bonnie and Clyde, when that was released, I don't remember a movie that got more systematically battered by prominent critics. And Pauline reviewed the movie and the reviewers. And a month later, it was on the cover of Time magazine, which had dismissed it in a kind of small, kind of anonymous paragraph as being in the vanguard of the new cinema.
Well, just the other night, me and Bonnie were talking, and we were talking about the time we were going to settle down and get us a home. And she says to me, she says, "You know, I couldn't bear to live more than 3 miles from my precious mother." Now, how'd you like that, Mother Parker?
I don't believe I would. I surely don't. You try to live 3 miles from me and you won't live long, honey. You best keep running, Clyde Barrow. And you know it.
I understand that Bonnie and Clyde was the first review that she wrote from her perch at The New Yorker. What was it that she loved so much about that film?
The moral stance of it seemed very original. On one hand, we saw them clearly. We saw them as killers, and we saw them in a certain sense as bumpkins. But at the same time, we loved them. We understood them. We understood how they got where they were. There were also a variety of tones. The movie began as a kind of a comedy and is very larky and then suddenly became very serious and very tragic, and she responded to that. She loved this kind of unruly mixture of tones.
I think she liked the fruitful mess approach as against the neoclassic approach. And, you know, Francis was nothing if not a fruitful mess, you know?
Francis Ford Coppola.
I work my own life. I don't apologize to take care of my family. And I refused to be a fool. Dancing on the string held by all those big shots. I don't apologize, that's my life, but I thought that... But when it was your time, that you would be the one to hold the strings.
How much do you think Pauline Kael was responsible for the success of The Godfather?
Her review of it was so extraordinary. It was something that found its way into the country and allowed the country to embrace it and have fun with it and also take it seriously. I think it really made a tremendous difference.
I mean, there was a time in the 70s when I was a teenager and then later in college when you used to go to a great movie, maybe you didn't, were having trouble sorting out your feelings about it, and you'd curl up with Pauline Kael and you'd sort of relive the movie and you'd see it through her eyes and you'd think, you'd compare your responses to her responses, and that was thrilling. I mean, that created this kind of a holy trinity among the work of art, the viewer, and the critic that I think is unmatched.
And it was the great and unexpected nature of her reviews. I mean, whether you agreed in every instance or not, what she was doing was discovering something in herself.
Did the movies always have to have somewhere within it a dark core for Kael to passionately champion it? For instance, when she reviewed the very early Spielberg film, The Sugarland Express, what did she have to say about Spielberg?
Hang on, I have it right here. She said, He isn't saying anything special, but he has a knack for bringing out young actors and a sense of composition and movement that almost any director might envy. And then she goes on to say, he could be that rarity among directors, a born entertainer, perhaps a new generation's Howard Hawks. I think she called him...
pretty good prognostication.
And this was a movie that not a lot of people, you know, were paying attention to. I mean, it was a small movie. It didn't do very well.
Yeah, I remember. Yeah, she was as capable of anyone surrendering herself to a guilty pleasure. And
it was never an unconditional surrender, but who cares?
Yeah. She didn't check her mind at the door, you know?
No, exactly. And she could, I mean, to put it very crudely, she'd go to bed with any movie. And that's why some directors hated her so much, because it's one thing to, you can dismiss criticism by sort of a loftier imperial critic, but somebody who's been to bed with you and who can point out your moves, even moves you didn't know you had, you know, that person gets under your skin in a very special way.
That's why she drove people crazy.
What do you think was her greatest contribution to the craft of filmmaking?
Well, there's been an awful lot of talk in recent years about the golden age of film, the 70s. Well, an awful lot of that came from somebody who created a common ground for audiences to appreciate that golden age of the 70s. And they made the filmmakers say, hey, man, we've got that audience. We can do this. We can do that. And studio executives would no more dream during that decade of messing around with an ending of yours than they would have trying to fly to the moon. And I think she was tremendously responsible for creating a climate, both in the part of the filmmaker and the film viewer, that encouraged and emboldened the filmmakers to make the kind of movies that were made then.
David?
I have nothing to add other than I miss her like crazy.
Yeah, me too. You know, I'm just quite shamelessly love the woman.
Robert Towne, thank you very much.
You guys take care, too.
And David, thank you so much.
Thank you, Brooke.
David Edelstein is the film reviewer for Slate.com, and Robert Towne has authored dozens of screenplays, including Shampoo, Chinatown, and Mission Impossible, and contributed to many others, among them Bonnie and Clyde and The Godfather. Coming up, why we love the British press, and maybe why we shouldn't, and a trip through the grimmer stretches of memory lane with the New York Daily News.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio. We're back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Nearly every week since September 11th, we've invited Martin Walker, international correspondent for UPI International, to review the foreign press and keep us apprised of what the rest of the world is saying. Martin, welcome back.
Thank you.
We've got what appears to be a war nearly won on our hands. Is that how the press you're reading is interpreting it?
Well, indeed, the Daily Telegraph of Britain is saying everyone who cast doubt on the possibilities of success and everyone who sneered at American gung-ho spirit should observe a period of silence. The rest of us should, to use a famous phrase from another war, just rejoice, rejoice. They're referring, of course, to Margaret Thatcher after the Falklands War.
Mm-hmm.
But in the leftish Libération of Paris, they say the collapse of the Taliban is a blessed surprise for the US and Great Britain and a huge relief for Paris. A sense of doubt fueled by pacifism and anti-Americanism had marked both the ranks of the French government and public opinion in general. The success of the war has made it possible to forget today the collateral damage of yesterday.
Ah, the dark note.
Well, indeed, because a lot of people are saying that, yes, the war has been won, but it's been won ugly.
By winning ugly, what do they mean? Collateral damage is certainly one thing. Any other quotations?
Yes, from Le Monde of Paris, talking about the battle in the prison camp just outside Mazar Sharif of Calais-Jangi. And they said that Calais-Jangi will go down in history as the place where no prisoners were taken, the symbolic place of a war after the war, like a love affair without end and with no other limits than capitulation by death and the silence of cemeteries. This will be a war long and pitiless. Frankfurt Allgemeine in Germany, which is a centrist kind of paper, is saying the war is not even half won, considering the political challenges that remain. The airstrikes and the Taliban's retaliation have prevented the transport of United Nations food aid, but worse still, the Western alliance has yet to win the Afghans' hearts and minds. Even if the price of Osama bin Laden T-shirts is lower than it was, many across South Asia remain convinced the United States is fighting not terrorism, but Islam as a whole.
So when they look ahead, do the newspapers that you read suggest that the next battle will be harder than the one we just pretty much have won? Or do they strike a more positive note given the experience we just had?
Well, no, they don't. I was very struck by the front page of one of Britain's mass tabloids, the Daily Mirror, which led its front page with a terrible colour photograph of a Taliban soldier with trousers around his ankles. And the headline, "Our civilized friends take over." And they called the win of the alliance a false victory. Many people rather worry that the next war is coming somewhere else. Frankfurt Allgemeine again. It's sobering to realize that nuclear terrorism is not just a hobby horse for idle strategists or politicians. It's a global task of the highest priority to make sure that weapons of mass destruction do not end up in the wrong hands. And in Iraq, they may already have done so. Die Welt goes on. Still euphoric from the quick win against the self-proclaimed army of God, President Bush seems inclined to resolve all the rest of the world's problems, but we are doubtful of the wisdom of attacking Baghdad, despite the well-based fears that Saddam Hussein is developing weapons of mass destruction again. One other voice I came across talking about a war in Iraq, and it was in the old Communist Party paper, Pravda. Today, America is being stampeded into a new undeclared war against Iraq. It's a time for truth, a time for the American Congress to do its duty and debate and decide whether we should have war or peace. And it was written by all people, Pat Buchanan, the old American conservative.
That great fellow traveler.
In Pravda, how the world has changed.
Martin Walker is international correspondent for UPI International.
The British newspaper The Guardian, before September 11th, typically would get between 100,000 and 200,000 website visits from the U.S. each month. Since then, it has averaged 700,000. Why the sudden interest in the British point of view? Part of the explanation is increased news consumption in general, but one analyst believes the explanation lies in British journalism's less responsible and therefore more provocative coverage. Trevor Butterworth is a research fellow at the Center for Media and Public Affairs in Washington, D.C., and he joins us now. Trevor, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So Americans seem to be flocking to British online newspapers. Is that true? What are the numbers?
Well, according to an internet consultant, the leading one, Jupiter Media Metrics, there are apparently in the region of 500,000 to 600,000 new American readers going to visit the British websites of papers like The Guardian and The Telegraph. Now, caveat emptor when you come to internet hits, what does that actually mean? It may mean that there's a lot less people if they're counted as page hits, but there seems to be, at least in the American press, a view that interesting stories are being reported out of Britain that are not getting covered in the American press.
Well, I must say, on my own website, I look at Yahoo, and I often see a very provocative headline that sends me to The Guardian or to The Times of London and so forth. What's the difference between the American coverage and the British that makes it seem so tempting?
Well, over the last 15 years, all the British papers have ratcheted up the drama quotient. They hector, they lure, the market is so competitive that to simply state the facts in a neutral, slightly dull way is not enough. Most American newspapers are virtual monopolies. At most, there are two newspapers competing for an audience. Now, translate the British experience of 10 national dailies into America. You would have the equivalent of 45 national newspapers competing for advertising and audience in every town across America. Now, that kind of free market pressure really erodes the possibility of quality journalism because quality journalism is very expensive. So you can't devote resources to long stories or to elaborate fact-checking or to putting loads of reporters on the beat. You tend to run with what is plausible.
Lurid headlines leading readers into unsubstantiated stories, that's a pretty serious charge. What's your bill of indictment? What particular stories were thinly sourced?
Well, in recent weeks, we had The Observer claim that there was going to be within 48 hours, U.S. airborne troops were going to go in and there was going to be a massive full-scale attack. Of course, it took a little bit longer for the airstrikes to begin. And
about
then,
3 weeks after the story.
Yes, yeah. And then only a handful of commandos went in. Then we had the Daily Times coming out with a story that said Osama bin Laden possesses nuclear material. And they spun this off into other stories, speculating about, you know, dirty bombs and, you know, and they came out with the brilliant line, this is the leaden shoe that's been waiting to drop. And the trouble was that nobody else was running this story. Subsequent investigation and reporting by other news sources and, of course, subsequent statements by President Bush, you know, said, well, they're looking, but we don't believe they actually have any material. Now, the point is, the Times could be true. But when you open a newspaper in the morning, you don't want your time to be wasted on the merely plausible.
Well, what's an American reader to do? How do you know whether you're reading a plausible but completely unsubstantiated story or just a really good scoop?
Check and see what the Financial Times is saying. They have an international reputation. They're appealing to an American market. They have kept faith with a sort of sober journalism that is the hallmark of journalistic quality in America and which used to be the hallmark of journalistic quality in Britain. So, you know, if they're saying it, I would be more confident. If they're not, I would be, you know, suspicious of the scoops that seem to come at a daily pace. I mean, most of my friends no longer read British newspapers who are in Ireland or in Britain. They just don't trust them. They think they're cartoons.
Trevor Butterworth, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Trevor Butterworth is a research fellow at the Center for Media and Public Affairs in Washington, D.C. Joining us now is Danny Schechter. He's the executive director of MediaChannel.org, where he writes a daily column, The News Dissector. Danny, welcome to On the Media.
Pleasure to be here.
Now, you read a lot of newspapers. What British papers do you read?
I look at The Independent, The Guardian, The Times of London, also BBC. And occasionally even the Mirror, which is a, you know, kind of tabloid daily.
So when you read stories in the British papers, do you get the sense that you're experiencing a lesser kind of journalism?
I don't think it's lesser. I think it's journalism as opposed to what we have in our country, which is called reporting. Journalism allows a journalist, a person who is an observer and an analyst, to give a reader a sense of whatever the story is that he's covering. The British journalists, the good ones, are fairly explicit and upfront about their values and where they're coming from, and anybody can see that. But they often have a much more critical perspective and a perspective that doesn't march in lockstep with the government as much as it seems that many of the major media outlets in the U.S. are doing.
We just spoke to Trevor Butterworth. He looks at scoops in the British papers, and he regards them as typically thinly sourced. Under the cover of news analysis, are British journalists just taking the opportunity to take thin stories and exaggerate them beyond what the story deserves?
A lot of it has to do with the particular story. I'm sure there are a lot of British stories that blow up a little bit of information or suspicions into stories, but the same thing is certainly true here. I mean, you on this program have talked about Wen Ho Lee and a lot of other charges and allegations that were made in our distinguished newspapers by top journalists that turned out to be not true, or at least not exactly what they appear to be. In a war situation, when we have a lack of information available right now, I've been surprised that the British journalists are actually getting information, hard investigative leads that do not appear often in the American press, so they do a day or two later.
Is it possible that what you see is maybe more courage from the British papers gives them cover to be simply less responsible, to be less rigorous about sourcing?
I think the sourcing issue is a canard. Now, it may be the case in certain specific stories that your critic here has studied in depth, but there's a climate of scrutiny. The Media Channel has 60 groups in the UK who are media critical in one way or another. So, you know, I think the climate there is not a climate of just indulging inaccurate journalism. To put the British press down when they're doing a much better job of covering the war is missing, big story for the minutiae.
Very well. Danny Schechter, thank you very much.
Thank you. Pleasure to be with you. Tally-ho.
Danny Schechter is executive producer of Global Vision and executive editor of MediaChannel.org.
The first modern tabloid was launched in Britain in 1903. Called the Daily Mirror, it was intended for women, but everybody read it, or more to the point, looked at it, and still does. And that included Joseph Medill Paterson, a scion of the Chicago Tribune, who made a crucial visit to publisher Lord Northcliffe after the First World War. Paterson took the idea back to America and launched that mother of all tabloids, the New York Daily News. Recently, a coffee table book arrived in our office filled with 80 years of gritty and grainy scenes of New York City from the Daily News. The first featured photograph is, weirdly, of a terrorist attack on Wall Street on a September day in 1920. The street is thronged with police and pedestrians, smoke and dust. The bomb that had blasted the headquarters of banking giant J.P. Morgan killed 30 and injured 400, and the crime was never solved. Newspaperman Pete Hamill wrote the essay that opens the book, New York Exposed. He says Patterson's New York abounded in the kind of characters that made for fabulous photos.
My favorite in the book is this. There's a photograph taken at the morgue, and there's a man on a slab whose face we don't see, but it's Monk Eastman, who was one of the first great Jewish gangsters. And he was sent to prison. He was sent to Sing Sing, got out in 1915, joined the army, and became this extraordinary war hero. You know, the Germans never saw anything like some tough Jew off the Lower East Side. They never saw anything like that in their lives. And he ended up getting a pardon for his heroic war service so he could vote again early and often. He was out 6 months. Prohibition was in, and he was shot to death by a crooked Prohibition agent. So in this photograph, he's the man on the slab. The coroner himself is standing there showing off the what we called in tabloids in my youth, the stiff. And watching are five or six of his followers, the little tough-looking Irish guys from up the block from where we are. And the notion, A, that you would have that kind of access, that's how young the medium was. You know, today it'd be unheard of for the coroner to let you into the morgue to take a photograph and let five gangsters go in, too.
In the heyday of the tabloid newspaper, how much did the photojournalist get involved in the story he was covering?
Well, I think a good example is the execution of Ruth Snyder, a famous murderess who helped hit her husband in the head with a sash weight and was the first, you know, was a woman electrocuted in Sing Sing. In that case, they brought a photographer from out of town, from Philadelphia. Then they slipped him in with a camera strapped to his ankle, and he took the famous photograph of Ruth Snyder getting hit with, 100,000 volts of electricity. It's out of focus. It's not particularly handsome as photography, but it's very mysterious and eerie. There's a guy looking as if he's watching something happening at the stock market rather than the taking of a human life. The Daily News became a sensation at the point. Great ethical quarrels and arguments in the other newspapers.
A quarrel that's still going on.
That's still going on. I mean, if you believe in capital punishment, in my opinion, you ought to ask that it be on all the networks. If its idea is to be a deterrent, let's go see it. And that sort of brought us face to face with what this was, that this is not some nice little clean operation in a chapel-like execution room, but something that's pretty horrific. And so in that case, I think you find the photographer being right in the middle of the story.
What was your overall impression of the themes and the eras portrayed in the 80 years of pictures we see in this book?
Looking at the earlier ones, I'm reminded so much of pictures of my father with his snap-brim fedora and the world in which to which he came in 1923 and my mother in 1929 from Ireland as immigrants. This was the world. And they used the Daily News to become Americans, as so many others did. It was much more important to them than reading de Tocqueville. You know, you picked up the news and said, this is what this place is about. And then there's specific things, the sports things, DiMaggio, the Pee Wee Reese, the Dodgers, the things that we lost. Because I think any history of any city is about the way we remember the things we have lost.
And what does this 80 years of photographs tell you about New York?
I didn't get the book in my hand until after September 11th, and it filled me with this great wash of emotion because it was the kind of world we seem to have lost on the morning of September 11th, a kind of world where people get hurt and people get murdered and people get executed and people dance on the decks of troop ships, and that all seemed like some innocent past where just the scale of things was so much smaller. Not just the scale of houses or buildings or skyscrapers, but the scale of calamity. 30 dead in 1920 as compared to 5,000 in September of this year is that shift in scale. I think the challenge to photographers is the same as the challenge to citizens. Can you look at the scale of these calamities and not harden your heart? You know, not grow callous around your heart and refuse to look at the world clearly. I think that's part of what a book like this or any examination of our history is about.
Pete Hamill, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Pete Hamill is a novelist and veteran newspaper man.
That'll do it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price and Katya Rogers, engineered by George Edwards, George Wellington, and Dylan Keefe, and edited by Brooke. Our old young friend Sean Landis is back, and our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Mike Pesca is our producer at large, Arun Roth, our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and get free transcripts at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from National Public Radio. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And she's Brooke Gladstone.
Support for On the Media is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Ford Foundation, the Bydell Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic Drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink. Drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.